Good day to you. This is Kathy Boughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am going to be reading from The Week. And we'll start off, as usual, with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's agenda-defining bill heads to Senate. What happened? President Trump's big, beautiful bill faced an uncertain path in the Senate this week, as some senators vowed to oppose the version that squeaked through the House, and Trump said he expected them to make fairly significant changes. House Speaker Mike Johnson won passage of the bill by a single vote after days of wrangling with both moderates who balked at benefits cuts and fiscal hawks who demanded steeper reductions. The House bill makes permanent the 2017 tax cuts passed under Trump, which were set to expire, and spends $150 billion on border enforcement. It also cuts food stamps by $268 billion and chops some $700 billion from Medicaid, largely by imposing work requirements. Johnson likened getting it through his fractious caucus to crossing over the Grand Canyon on a piece of dental floss, and urged the Senate to make as few modifications as possible. Some senators made it clear they had other plans, with a nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimating the bill would add $3.8 trillion over a decade to the $36 trillion national debt. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican, Wisconsin, voted to hold out for significant spending cuts. Somebody's got to be the dad that says, "I know y'all want to go to Disney World, but we can't afford it," he said. Senator Rand Paul, Republican, Kentucky, refused to accept the bill's hike in the debt limit, while several moderates balked at the Medicaid cuts that the CBO predicts will strip health insurance from 7.6 million Americans. With all Democrats opposed, Majority Leader John Thune can only lose 3 GOP votes, and anything the Senate passes has to be able to clear the divided House. "We're a long ways from the finish line," said Senator Mike Rounds, Republican, South Dakota. What the editorial said? Trump's bill is big, all right, but it's as ugly and malodorous as a heap of garbage under a broiling sun, said the South Florida Sun Sentinel. In addition to stripping millions of their health insurance, it would pull food stamps from 3 million poor people, all to make the rich wealthier, by extending tax cuts that overwhelmingly favor the top 10%. And it adds trillions to our already staggering debt. When senators return from break, they should do what's right for the country and rewrite this monstrosity. The Medicaid cuts have drawn predictable wails from Democrats, said the New York Post, but in truth, they don't go nearly far enough. Outlays have skyrocketed, going from $160 billion in 2003 to $591 billion in 2023, as Democrats expanded Medicaid to cover not just the poor, but also the near poor and even the not really poor at all, insisting that able-bodied Americans' work to receive public charity is the least of the needed fixes. What the columnist said? "Republicans aren't really targeting Medicaid fraud," said Pamela Hurd and Donald P. Moynihan in the New York Times. 92% of recipients are already working, disabled, or have another qualifying exemption, such as caregiving. The real goal of the work requirement is to drive off millions of legitimate beneficiaries by overwhelming them with pointless paperwork and other bureaucratic hurdles. It's a sneaky way to dodge political fallout while slashing a program favored by most Americans, including the Republicans' own voters. "So much for Trump the reformer," said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review. He was supposed to be the fearless corrective for livy-livered establishment Republicans who always promised to cut spending, reform welfare, and balance the budget, then inevitably fail to follow through. So what does he deliver? A bill that guarantees that deficits will grow and our already spiraling national debt will continue to mount indefinitely. The Trump-led GOP has behaved in precisely the same manner as did the old guard that it claims to disdain. Don't kid yourself that the Senate will save us, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. This bill is the centerpiece of Trump's agenda, and members of his party aren't going to snuff it at the finish line. And that's too bad, because it's garbage from tip to tail. Serving up incoherent policies like cutting taxes on tips, it explodes the debt while making no pretense of trying to grapple seriously with America's problems. Handed full control of the White House and Congress, the GOP has barfed up a bill that makes sense only as a sort of formal surrender of America's status as a serious country. It wasn't all bad. Across a 50-plus year career teaching art history at New College of Florida in Sarasota, Chris Hasselt came to call some of her students her children. When she died at 89, without a family of her own, 31 of her former students learned they would inherit a share of her $2.8 million estate. The gifts ranged from $26,000 to $560,000, and the former students used the money to travel, pay debt, and even buy a new home. We were her family, said former pupil Ryan White. She adopted us, and we adopted her. In April, biologists with California's Department of Fish and Wildlife rescued an abandoned black bear cub from Los Padres National Forest. They sent the two-month-old, weighing 3 pounds, to the Ramona Wildlife Center in San Diego. The center wants to release the cub in a year, so the staff pretends the cub never left the forest as it learns to survive in the wild. Two habitats are equipped with stuffed bears, and when the staff needs to interact or feed the bear, they don a bear mask, fur coat, and leather gloves and cover themselves in bear scent. There is nothing like releasing a bear back to the wild, said wildlife manager Autumn Welch. It's an amazing feeling. Days into a cruise to Vanuatu, Captain Idu Ferron of the Carnival Splendor learned of a battered catamaran's distress signal some 100 miles away. Ferron traveled to the vessel's last coordinates, using flares as guides through the night. 5 hours later, the Splendor drew alongside the sailboat and used a rope ladder to rescue its owner, Dustin Leonard, his fiancée, Helena Francek, two crew members, and three sea dogs, Juno, Potato, and Wiggle. In the future, Francek said, she'll wave at every cruise ship she encounters and send them lots of love. Frustrated Trump warns crazy Putin. What happened? President Trump's friendly relationship with Vladimir Putin soured this week after he called the Russian dictator absolutely crazy for unleashing his largest ever missile and drone barrage on Ukrainian civilians. The Kremlin dismissed Trump's comments as evidence of emotional overload, even as it continued its days-long bombardment of Ukraine with more than 1,300 drones and 90 missiles, killing at least 30 civilians and wounding more than 160. Frustrated that Putin was snubbing his efforts to negotiate peace, Trump warned that the Russian leader was playing with fire and that continuing the war will lead to the downfall of Russia. The Kremlin claimed it would present its peace memorandum, outlining its terms for a deal, at an upcoming meeting with the Ukrainians. Trump said he'd determine in about 2 weeks whether Putin is serious about a deal before supporting punitive sanctions, including those in a Senate bill that would slap a 500% U.S. tariff on goods from countries that buy Russian oil and gas. Putin has thus far shown no interest in modifying his maximalist demands, including demilitarizing Ukraine and requiring it to be neutral rather than aligned with the West. In response to intensified Russian aerial attacks and troop movements, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz announced there would be no more range restrictions on Western-provided weaponry. A grateful Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged other world leaders to step up and help end Moscow's sense of total impunity. What the columnist said? Trump's stamping his feet on social media may be childishly ineffective, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, but it might signal that he finally comprehends Putin's true goals. his erstwhile pal's continuing slaughter of civilians is now a liability for Trump, making him look foolish and powerless. Comically, he claimed last week that he'd always said that Putin wants all of Ukraine, which conveniently ignores that Trump has repeatedly blamed Zelensky and Joe Biden for somehow starting a war that began with Russia's invasion. Trump may be the only person in the world still surprised by how Putin is behaving, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, and he should now listen to the genuine realists in the Senate. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has 82 bipartisan co-sponsors on legislation that would severely punish buyers of Russian energy, Putin's financial lifeline. Trump has two options, said Stephen Colinson in CNN.com. He could start supporting Ukraine's fight for survival by resuming arms shipments, though that would be embarrassing politically, or he could throw up his hands and totally end U.S. involvement, letting Putin's war of attrition grind on for years. The only way to halt the war is with fierce Western pressure, including both arms sales and increased sanctions, said Tamar Jacoby in The Bulwark. But despite his tough talk, Trump has done nothing yet to punish or pressure the Kremlin, and it's unclear he ever will. Harvard faces expanded White House war. What happened? The Trump administration this week moved to revoke Harvard's ability to enroll international students and signaled that it could use similar leverage in a broader campaign against universities. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem last week revoked Harvard's access to the Student and Exchange Visitor Program, alleging the university had failed to curb anti-Semitism on campus. Harvard quickly sued, and a federal judge temporarily paused Noem's order, which would force the nearly 6,800 current foreign students to transfer or leave the U.S. The Trump administration this week also directed government agencies to cancel $100 million in remaining federal contracts with Harvard. The White House previously froze more than $3 billion in federal grants after Harvard refused to comply with a list of demands. On Truth Social, Trump said he was considering permanently taking grant money from a very anti-Semitic Harvard and giving it to trade schools all across our land. Shortly after the new Harvard restrictions, the State Department ordered all U.S. embassies and consular sections to halt scheduling new interviews for all student visa applications, regardless of the applicant's college, while the government develops guidelines for vetting their social media accounts. More than 1 million international students attend college in the U.S. every year. Foreign universities responded with offers to take transfer students, including the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, which issued an open invitation to current Harvard students. What the columnist said? Trump suffers from Harvard derangement syndrome, said Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker in the New York Times. The oldest university in the United States has serious ailments, but it's neither a woke madrasa nor a Maoist indoctrination camp. There are prominent conservative faculty members who regularly challenge university policies. And if Harvard really taught its students to despise the free market system, it seems unlikely that economics and computer science would be the school's top undergraduate concentrations, or that so many grads would go into finance, consulting, and technology. This is badly understating the problems with Harvard, said Stanley Kurtz in National Review. Yes, Pinker and like-minded professors have defended heterodox opinions, but there are few of those because Harvard has already purged the faculty of conservative voices and destroyed the very basis of academic freedom at Harvard. The college is so committed to indoctrination that nonpartisan courses like engineering or science are the bait that draws students into ideological manipulation. Too bad Trump's battle with Harvard isn't actually about higher education reform, said Adam Sewer in The Atlantic. It's part of a comprehensive attack on knowledge itself, a war against culture, history, and science that goes beyond academia. Like the inquisitors who persecuted Galileo, this administration believes that truth-seeking imperils their hold on power. Controversy of the week. Anti-Semitism, what a young couple's murder tells us. Yaron Leshinsky and Sarah Milgram were young and in love, said Gil Pruitz in Haaretz, Israel. Leshinsky, 30, had just bought Milgram, 26, an engagement ring and planned to propose next week. But there will be no proposal and no wedding. Last week, as the idealist young couple left the peace event at the Capital Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C., where both worked at the Israeli embassy, they were murdered by Elias Rodriguez, 31, who first shot them in the back, then calmly reloaded and finished Milgram off as she tried to crawl away. I did it for Gaza, Rodriguez told police. He clearly assumed his victims were Jews, making this a textbook case of anti-Semitic terrorism. Leshinsky was born to a Jewish father and Christian mother and was both a practicing Christian and an Israeli citizen. The violent hatred didn't come out of the blue. Anti-Semitic incidents have purged 893% over the past decade, says the Anti-Defamation League, and the wave has been supercharged by Hamas's October 7th massacre of Israelis and Israel's military response. Rodriguez undoubtedly sees himself as a hero to the Palestinian cause, not as a mere anti-Semite, said Emma Green in The New Yorker. But by slaughtering two people whose lives he knew nothing about, he followed the ugly and ancient logic of anti-Semitism, which holds every Jew, anywhere, personally responsible for all the ills of the world. Jew hatred is a long and bloody history, said Jeffrey Blair in National Review. But this feels like something new. Rodriguez is from Chicago, not Gaza or the West Bank. He's not Palestinian or even Muslim, and his social media accounts reveal an almost frighteningly generic range of young progressive activist views. Rodriguez applauded Luigi Mangione, the alleged murderer of a UnitedHealthcare CEO, and like Mangione, was driven not by mental illness or personal grievance, but by progressive empathy to a cause and the online left's maximalist rhetoric of panic, siege, and destruction. Make no mistake, the progressive ecosystem is breeding killers. And the right-wing ecosystem isn't? Asked Carlo J.V. Caro in the New York Daily News. After a gunman murdered 11 worshipers at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018, the killer's online history revealed a slew of ranting posts on Gab, an early MAGA platform, about Jews' involvement in the great replacement of white Americans with immigrants. Many of the alienated young men who voted for President Trump are followers of far-right anti-Semitic influencers, such as Andrew Tate, Tucker Carlson, and Nick Fuentes, said Zachary Basu in Axios. Holocaust denial and racist tropes about Jewish influence are now standard fare on the MAGA-friendly podcasts and platforms that help get Trump elected, including Joe Rogan's. The hatred of Jews is no longer a fringe opinion in this country, said Rian Salam and Jesse Arm in The Atlantic. We can't criminalize hateful speech, but we can draw a clear line against political violence and its glorification. We must use our legal system and our voices to affirm the principle that no political grievance justifies murder. Whether it emanates from the fever swamps on the left or right, said the Washington Post in an editorial, politically motivated violence in America cannot be tolerated. Only by punishing such atrocities to the fullest extent of the law and making them counterproductive to the causes they seek to advance can we keep them from becoming contagious. Only in America. Two GOP House members want the National Institutes of Health to conduct a taxpayer-funded study of Trump derangement syndrome. The TDS Research Act, from Representatives Warren Davidson of Ohio and Barry Moore of Alabama, would direct the NIH to study the psychological and social roots of the extreme negative reactions to President Donald J. Trump. The Texas House of Representatives has approved a bill that would let voters carry concealed firearms into polling places. The move comes as poll workers in Texas and nationwide have reported a rise in the frequency of death threats and physical assaults. In a letter, civil rights and gun safety groups pleaded with legislators to reject the bill. Polling places, they said, are and must remain neutral, non-intimidating environments where voters can exercise their constitutional right free from fear or coercion. The bill passed 83-50 and now goes to the state Senate. It was a good week for the Arizona Cardinals, whose home State Farm Stadium in Glendale was ranked first out of all 30 NFL stadiums as a place to ride out a zombie apocalypse. A betting site's tongue-in-cheek report gave State Farm high marks for its closable roof, limited entry points, and natural grass field that is capable of growing crops. It was a good week for Precocity. After 11-year-old Alyssa Perales graduated from a community college in California with associate degrees in math and multiple sciences. Homeschooled by her father from the age of one, Alyssa obviously had some innate spark, said Dad Rafael Perales, but she has put in the work. She's moving on to the University of California, Irvine. It was a good week for wisdom born of experience. After President Trump advised the graduating class at West Point to avoid trophy wives, the thrice-married commander-in-chief, whose third wife spends little time with him, warned cadets that seeking glamorous young replacements doesn't work out too well, I must tell you. A lot of trophy wives, it doesn't work. It was a bad week for concentration. After a Microsoft study found that, on average, modern office workers are interrupted by emails, meetings, and assorted other pings every 2 minutes. It was a bad week for FUBAR regulations. After an Army unit in Missouri responsible for accepting new recruits imposed a strict no-cussing policy in response to complaints of extreme profanity. The new policy bans all profanity, vulgar language, rude gestures, or remarks. It was a bad week for Emmanuel Macron after a TV video showed the French president being shoved hard in the face by wife Bridget as they prepared to get off a plane in Vietnam. Macron later admitted the couple was bickering, but said the face shove was not a global catastrophe. And in other news, the High Court expands Trump's power to fire agency heads. The Supreme Court ruled last week in favor of an emergency request from President Trump to fire commissioners on the National Labor Relations Board. The court's 6-3 conservative majority ruled that limiting the president's right to fire independent agency heads infringes on his constitutional powers. In a dissent, the three liberal justices said this order lets the president overrule a 90-year-old precedent by fiat. Trump moved earlier this year to fire President Biden's appointees to the NLRB, as well as the Merit Systems Protection Board, which protects federal employees, earlier this year. The ruling lets the president go ahead with dismissals as litigation continues, and it is likely to apply to other agencies, such as the Federal Trade Commission. However, the justices noted that the ruling did not apply to the Federal Reserve, an unusual statement that may reassure financial markets. Turning to the U.S. at a glance, Minneapolis, no oversight. The Justice Department last week moved to end federal oversight of investigations of nearly 24 police departments accused of violating civil rights, abandoning a Biden-era initiative that stemmed from a series of high-profile police killings of black people in 2020. The DOJ was investigating the police department in Minneapolis, where the police killing of George Floyd kicked off national protests. There were also civil rights investigations into departments in cities such as Memphis, Phoenix, Oklahoma City, Trenton, New Jersey, Mount Vernon, New York, and Louisville, where police killed 26-year-old Breonna Taylor while executing a search warrant in 2020. Harmeet Dhillon, head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, was also considering ending federal oversight arrangements in cities like Baltimore, Cleveland, Newark, and Ferguson, Missouri. Federal micromanagement of local police should be a rare exception and not the norm, Dhillon said. Potomac Falls, Virginia. Crypto banquet. President Trump hosted a private black tie gala last week at Trump National Golf Club for the 220 top buyers of his crypto coin, calling the event the most exclusive invitation in the world. Guests had spent a combined $148 million on Trump coin tokens. Chinese-born crypto mogul Justin Sun, who currently faces fraud charges, holds the most Trump coin tokens with over $22 million. Former basketball star Lamar Odom also attended to promote his Odom token, calling Trump the greatest president. Security was lax, with guests allowed to keep their phones. About 100 protesters gathered outside, joined by Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat, Oregon. Trump promised the top 25 spenders a private meeting and guided tour, but other guests left unimpressed. The president appeared for just 23 minutes and didn't speak to most people, according to 25-year-old Nicholas Pinto. The food sucked, he said. Wasn't given any drinks other than water or Trump's wine. Boston, deportation limbo. A federal judge in Boston criticized the Trump administration this week for failing to grant due process to migrants being held in limbo in Djibouti days after he'd blocked their deportation to South Sudan. Judge Brian Murphy ruled last week that six of the eight men the administration aimed to deport to South Sudan were owed reasonable fear interviews and said they were given less than 16 hours notice before the removal, rather than the mandated 15 days. After Murphy's ruling blocked the administration from handing the migrants over to the South Sudanese government, their plane landed in Djibouti in East Africa. The migrants come from countries such as Cuba, Mexico, Vietnam, and South Sudan, which is on the edge of civil war. Their lawyer said the detainees hadn't been given access to their legal representation in Djibouti. Murphy wrote acidly that if having immigration proceedings on another continent was too cumbersome from the government, it could bring the detainees back to the United States. The world at a glance. Ottawa, standing with Canada. King Charles III highlighted Canadian independence in a speech to the Canadian Parliament this week, saying, "The true North is indeed strong and free." While the King didn't mention President Trump by name, his remarks were seen as a show of defiance against Trump's call to make Canada a U.S. state. Prime Minister Mark Carney had invited Charles to deliver the traditional throne speech, which is written by the government to outline parliamentary priorities and is typically read by the Governor General. Charles, who is titular head of state for Canada, Australia, and the other Commonwealth countries, was the first British monarch to deliver the speech since 1977. Soon after he spoke, Trump posted on social media that Canada would get free protection from the proposed Golden Dome missile defense system if it joined the U.S. Javari Valley, Brazil. Not porn addicts. A remote Amazonian tribe is suing the New York Times over an article suggesting its youth had become addicted to internet porn. The suit, which also names TMZ and Yahoo, said the article portrayed the Marubo community of 2,000 people as having spiraled into moral and social decline after the arrival of Elon Musk's Starlink satellite internet service. The tribe benefits from using the internet to communicate with the outside world, the article said, but now suffer the same ills as the rest of the world, including teenagers glued to phones and minors exposed to porn. The Times, which ran a follow-up under the headline, "No, a remote Amazon tribe did not get addicted to porn," said its story offered a sensitive and nuanced account of the benefits and drawbacks of technology. Mount Everest, Nepal. Everest Man. Nepali Sherpa Kami Rita, 55, summited Mount Everest for the 31st time this week, breaking his own world record. Known as Everest Man, he first climbed the world's tallest peak in 1994. This year's ascent, in which he helped lead 22 Indian Army personnel, was particularly difficult, and the team had to pause for bad weather. Last week, four British men set a different record by summiting Everest in less than a week. It usually takes foreign climbers many days at base camp and at each higher camp to adjust to the altitude. These men skip those steps by inhaling xenon, which speeds the body's adjustment to low oxygen. This can be the future of commercially guided mountaineering on Mount Everest, said expedition organizer Lucas Furtenbach. He said faster climbs would leave much less waste on the mountain. People. Hargitay's two fathers. Mariska Hargitay always felt she was different from her siblings, said Joy Press in Vanity Fair, but it wasn't until her 20s that she understood why. The daughter of Hollywood bombshell Jane Mansfield, the Law & Order SVU star, had long thought her biological father was the Hungarian bodybuilding champ turned actor Mickey Hargitay. Then, at 25, she saw a photo of Nelson Sardelli, the Italian entertainer Mansfield dated during a brief separation from Mickey in 1963. Hargitay, born the following year, instantly knew Sardelli was her biological father. It was like the floor fell out from underneath me, she says. When she was 30, Hargitay went to see Sardelli perform in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and introduced herself. He burst into tears and said he'd waited years for this moment. Hargitay, now 61, had the opposite reaction. I was like, I don't want anything. I don't need anything from you. I have a dad. I wanted to be loyal to Mickey, the father who had raised her after Mansfield's death in a 1967 car crash. Yet, she couldn't help but wonder if she'd been living a lie my entire life, and whether she was a wanted child or an illegitimate mistake. Hargitay slowly formed a bond with Sardelli, but also came to believe that I grew up where I was supposed to. I'm Mickey Hargitay's daughter. That is not a lie. Billy Joel announced last week he's canceling his upcoming concerts, including a major tour planned to last through next summer, after he was diagnosed with a brain disorder. Normal pressure hydrocephalus, a rare condition caused by excess cerebral spinal fluid in the brain, is treatable, but can cause symptoms such as urinary incontinence and an unsteady gait, as well as cognitive impairment. A statement posted to the Piano Man singer's social media revealed that Joel, 76, has been dealing with hearing, vision, and balance problems that were exacerbated by recent concert performances. A prolific performer, Joel completed a decade-long residency at Madison Square Garden last year. A briefing, flying into danger. America's air traffic control system is in crisis. Can it be fixed? What's wrong with the system? For starters, there's an acute shortage of air traffic controllers who are responsible for directing about 45,000 flights carrying 2.9 million passengers every day. The Federal Aviation Administration has about 13,800 certified controllers at more than 300 facilities, which is 3,000 below the recommended staffing number. With 90% of control towers understaffed, controllers are routinely expected to put in 10-hour days, 6 days a week. And those controllers have to rely on what the FAA describes as outdated technologies that are unable to meet modern demands. Partly because of those cascading problems, 2023 saw 19 serious runway incursions at U.S. airports where a collision was narrowly avoided, the highest number in nearly a decade. Public concern over air traffic control swelled in January after 67 people died in a mid-air crash between a military helicopter and a commercial flight over Washington, D.C. A preliminary FAA report said staffing at the control tower was abnormally low for the shift. And concern surged again in April when controllers for New Jersey's Newark Liberty International Airport lost communication with planes for about 90 seconds due to a single burned-out copper wire. The next month, an air traffic control facility in Colorado suffered a similar outage. "It's a crisis, and the public doesn't know about it," said one Newark controller. "Nobody wants to pay attention until lives are lost." Why is there a staffing shortage? Air traffic control is a historically understaffed profession, and the pandemic only made things worse. When COVID hit and air travel slowed, the training of new recruits was put on hold, even as many older controllers opted for retirement. These experienced workers can't be quickly replaced. To be considered for an air traffic control spot, candidates must be under 31, have U.S. citizenship, and pass a background check, skills assessment, and medical exam. Only about 10% of applicants to the FAA Academy in Oklahoma City are accepted. The Academy has capacity for 2,500 students, but this year received only 1,950, and only about two-thirds of those complete the training program. "It's a lot of work," said one student. "It's like a full two-year degree in 4 months." After graduating, another 2 to 3 years of classroom and on-the-job experience is required to become a certified controller. The career lifespan of a controller is limited because the profession has a mandatory retirement age of 56. Many quit before then, despite earning six-figure salaries. Why is turnover high? Because it's a stressful job that controllers are expected to do in often less than ideal conditions. In recent years, controllers have submitted hundreds of complaints about rundown facilities with bug and mold infestations, dangerous staffing shortages, and unstable colleagues. Between 2021 and 2023, the FAA received at least 7 reports of controllers sleeping on duty and 5 of people working while under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Some controllers develop physical and/or mental health problems because of nonstop schedules, but avoid seeking professional help lest it cost them their medical clearance. The result is a demoralized, distracted, and exhausted workforce that is more prone to making mistakes. A database of air safety issues maintained by NASA includes numerous accounts of mistakes by weary controllers, including one from a staffer in Southern California who instructed a plane to fly too low and attributed the error to being extremely tired after continuous overtime. What about technology issues? Much of the equipment in control towers is decades old and analog. While other countries use digital displays and infrared-based systems, American air traffic controllers are trained to use floppy disks, paper flight tracking strips, and World War II-era radars. Nick Daniels, president of National Air Traffic Controllers Association, told a March congressional hearing that the FAA has failed to request adequate funding for infrastructure needs for 2 decades. The agency's annual $3 billion budget for facilities and equipment, he said, has forced it to adopt a fix-on-fail model that leaves little to no money for modernization. Is anyone trying to repair the system? The Trump administration has promised to supercharge the hiring of controllers who have been spared the cuts inflicted on other government workers. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy recently announced a $5,000 bonus for FAA Academy graduates, with an additional $10,000 for those willing to work at one of the 13 facilities deemed hard to staff, as well as annual 20% bonuses for controllers who stay on past the retirement eligibility mark at 25 years. Duffy has also unveiled plans to replace 618 old radars and build 6 new air traffic control centers, the largest such project since the 1960s. The tax bill currently working its way through Congress includes $12.5 billion for a modernization over the next 3 years. But the Modern Skies Coalition, an organization that includes unions, aircraft manufacturers, and trade groups, says an extra $18.5 billion in emergency funding is needed. Is it still safe to fly? Air travel remains by far the safest mode of transportation. The crash over Washington attracted so much attention, in part because of the rarity of such accidents in the U.S. It was the first fatal American commercial air disaster since 2009, and the worst since 2001. But some aviation experts worry that, after years of safety improvements, things may now be going backward. I have friends and family asking, should I get on an airplane? One retired controller told Axios. And I'm like, well, it's not there yet, but it seems to be trending that way. A push for privatization. Could a private company run air traffic control better than the government? It's not a new question. The Clinton administration proposed privatization in 1995, only to back away in the face of opposition from corporate jet owners and private pilots who pay almost nothing to use the current system. Following the crisis at Newark and elsewhere, lawmakers are again contemplating privatization, which would free air traffic control from cumbersome government procurement requirements that slow the adoption of new technologies. Advocates note that in recent decades, some 60 countries have separated air traffic control from their aviation safety regulators, often by creating an independent government corporation or other nonprofit provider. Under that arrangement, Canada today handles more air traffic with fewer controllers than it did three decades ago. Flying from Canada to the U.S. is like time travel for pilots, said aviation consultant Scott McCartney. You leave a modern air traffic control system run by a company and enter one run by the government, struggling to catch up. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. A morning news anchor for a New York TV station did her broadcast while in labor. Olivia Jakeith of CBS 6 Albany soldiered on when her water broke shortly before the 5 a.m. broadcast. We do have some breaking news this morning, literally, said co-anchor Julia Dunn. Olivia is anchoring the news now in active labor. Jakeith said she thought it was better to pass the time at work rather than nervously waiting around the hospital. She later gave birth to a healthy baby boy, Quincy. What a wild 24 hours, she said. A Norwegian man awoke to find that a massive container ship had run aground within 5 yards of his home at the edge of a fjord. Johan Helberg slept through the commotion as the 443-foot ship crashed into the shore just before 6 a.m., waking up only when a neighbor frantically rang his doorbell. It was so unreal, said Helberg, of seeing the ship looming over his house. I went to the window and was quite astonished. I impressed myself by staying cool. Police say the crewman guiding the ship told them he fell asleep. More than 160 people are signed up to run in a clothing-optional 5K race at a South Carolina nudist resort. The Buck Creek Streak at the Carolina Foothills Resort is in its 11th year and has grown steadily from 25 participants in the first one to 138 last year. The June 14th race has 161 registered runners so far. Running in a crowd unencumbered by clothes is a great time, said resort board member Tom Crowder. You can go anywhere and do a 5K, but you can't go anywhere and run a 5K naked. Best columns, Europe. How they see us. Has Trump finally seen through Putin? Vladimir Putin has been playing Donald Trump for a fool, said Mykola Niazitsky in Espresso, Ukraine. And it looks like the U.S. president might finally be catching on. Russia hit Ukraine this week with one of its most intense bombardments of the war, pounding Kyiv and other cities with hundreds of drones and missiles. In response, Trump expressed his outrage on social media, saying Putin had gone absolutely crazy and was needlessly killing a lot of people. Just days earlier, Trump had seemed to be going easy on Putin, abandoning his threat of sanctions after talking to him on the phone. It's encouraging if Trump now sees Putin for the madman he is. But what took him so long? A sane leader does not start a war, does not send hundreds of thousands of his citizens to die for no reason, and does not destroy his own country. The question now is whether Trump will respond to this latest barrage forcefully or effectively admit defeat to Putin. Don't expect Trump to get tough, said Sophia Dreisbach in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, Germany. One social media rant doesn't mean he has lost patience with Putin. For months now, Trump has been alternately admiring of Putin and exasperated by him. He boasted he would end the war on day one of his presidency, but 4 months on, he seems to have given up trying. His vacillating allows Putin to grab more Ukrainian territory to use as leverage in eventual peace talks. And even in the same post criticizing Putin, Trump couldn't resist taking a fresh swipe at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, saying, "Everything that comes out of his mouth causes problems." The reality is that only Putin can stop the war, said Irina Gerashenko in New Voice, Ukraine. The U.S. and the EU must try to create such hellish conditions that Putin realizes peace is his best option. To that end, Europe has proposed new sanctions on the shadow fleet of tankers Russia uses to distribute its oil to finance the war. And German Chancellor Friedrich Merz announced this week that the West, including the U.S., was lifting restrictions on Ukraine's use of Western-supplied long-range weapons. That will allow Kyiv to fire at targets deep inside Russia. As long as the U.S. stands firmly alongside Europe, it will show Putin that the era of Russia's impunity is over. Putin has already blinked, said Mykolaj Suchy in the Kyiv Independent, Ukraine. This week's historic prisoner exchange, in which 1,000 Ukrainian prisoners of war were traded for 1,000 Russians, should prove to Trump that U.S. pressure on Russia makes a difference. Putin sees Ukrainian POWs as an asset, and his willingness to hand over so many of them could mean we've reached a tipping point. Don't bet on it, said Igal Levin in Obozy Votol, Ukraine. As Danish military analyst Anders Nielsen pointed out, Putin sees this conflict as a defensive war. He is defending Russia's status as a great power. After the Baltic states joined NATO, he lost any chance of bringing them back into Russia's sphere of influence. No matter what it costs him, he won't let that happen to Ukraine. Talking points. George Floyd. Did Black Lives Matter fail? George Floyd's murder sparked the racial reckoning that wasn't, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. This week marked 5 years since Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Footage of Floyd's death, with Chauvin's kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds while Floyd gasped, "I can't breathe," ushered in a Black Lives Matter movement that galvanized millions to push for racial progress. White people started speaking about the impact of racism, while companies rushed to announce DEI initiatives. Buildings, schools, and roads were renamed. Statues came down. But many of the initiatives promoted by the movement, like police reform, never came to fruition. The number of people killed by police has increased every year since 2020, and the looting that coincided with some protests enabled Republicans to portray a national multiracial uprising as a race riot. Some conservatives now even claim Chauvin didn't murder Floyd and have called on President Trump to pardon him. For a brief, inspiring moment in our history, Black Lives Matter seemed to be a turning point. But a backlash fueled by fear helped return Trump to office on a wave of white identity politics. We should be grateful we escaped a dangerous societal overhaul, said Mike Gonzalez in the Wall Street Journal. Floyd's death was a tragedy that Marxists manipulated into a revolutionary moment that saw 2,385 looting incidents and 624 arson incidents. the nation fell into a trance, with corporations and cultural institutions pledging obeisance to the new creed. A mass delusion portrayed America as an oppressive nation gripped by systemic racism, whose reigning ideology was white supremacy. Fortunately, America fought back. Floyd's murder was a national shame, not a delusion, said Nakima Levi Armstrong in USA Today. Still, much of 2020's momentum has quietly evaporated. Corporate promises of diversity and inclusion have been abandoned. When the protests faded, an army of reactionaries went to work, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Instead of racial progress, we got a Trump-led white backlash. The words diversity and racism have been demonized and banned. Even Washington, D.C.'s Black Lives Matter Plaza has been scrubbed clean of its bright yellow letters, erasing one of the movement's most lasting symbols. In the current climate of fear, retribution, and repression, it's almost impossible to imagine how the spark of positive energy that swept America 5 years ago could be reignited. Business news at a glance. Trade. iPhone threatened with new tariffs. Apple is on the firing line in President Trump's latest tariff push, said Jesse Pound in CNBC.com. The president last week threatened 25% tariffs on Apple devices unless the company moves production to the United States. Trump also said he would place a 50% levy on imports from the European Union, which he later paused. But he has kept the pressure on Apple, which has been shifting manufacturing to India to avoid Trump's trade war with China. In practice, Apple is far more likely to pay the levy than to shift iPhone production away from Asia. Wedbush analyst Dan Ives put the estimated cost of a U.S. iPhone at $3,500. A U.S.-made iPhone would be a triumph for Trump's MAGA doctrine, said Issy Lepowski in Vanity Fair. It would not just be a display of the country's old-school industrial strength. It would also be a show of force exhibiting Trump's power over one of the most powerful companies in the world. History, however, suggests that Apple need not commit to a total supply chain overhaul. Trump has always been about the fanfare rather than the follow-through. Apple has reportedly already drafted a plan to assemble iPhones in America. That and a decent photo op may be all that Trump really wants. And looking at obituaries, the everyman actor who was Norm on Cheers, George Wendt, 1948 to 2025. When George Wendt's agent sent him to audition for a new sitcom set in a Boston bar, she warned him the part was small. He was to speak just one word, beer. But the producers of Cheers saw something in the portly actor with the regular Joe air, and they hatched another plan. Wendt was cast as fan favorite Norm Peterson, the beer-quaffing barfly who was glued to a bar stool in every one of the Smash show's 275 episodes, from 1982 to 1993. An underemployed accountant, the stoic Norm dodged his wife, bantered with fellow regular Cliff Clavin, and with unerring comic timing, dropped deadpan one-liners on barkeeps Sam and Woody. How's a beer sound? I don't know. I usually finish them before they get a word in. Wendt, who received 6 Emmy nominations, allowed that playing an average guy who loves cold ones didn't exactly require heroic shape-shifting from him. Norm is just me with better writing, he said in 2021. One of 9 children, Wendt grew up in Chicago, where his father ran a real estate agency, said the Washington Post. After Jesuit prep school, he attended Notre Dame, where he was invited to leave because of hard partying, lack of focus, and poor grades. He fared better at Rockhurst College, earning an economics degree. But a straight job held little interest, and with virtually no experience, he decided to pursue acting. Returning to Chicago, he did years of training at workshops run by the storied Second City Comedy Troupe before finally joining both the resident and touring companies. In 1980, he moved to Hollywood, finding favor with his easy charm and lunch pail demeanor, said the New York Times. He appeared on shows such as Taxi and Alice before attending the fateful Cheers audition. After Cheers, Wendt landed his own sitcom, said the Times, UK, The George Wendt Show, in which he played a mechanic, bombed and was canceled after a few episodes. Still, in later years, he was rarely out of work. He appeared in numerous films, on Broadway in Elf and Hairspray, and on TV series such as Portlandia and Seinfeld. Over the years, he reprised Norm on shows like The Simpsons and the Cheers spinoff Frasier. He co-wrote a 2009 book, Drinking with George, that was part memoir, part love letter to his favorite beverage. Will Rogers once said he never met a man he didn't like, he wrote. I feel the same about beer. This is Kathy Broughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading The Week. Thanks for listening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast/info/audio/on-demand. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.